This is a critical point in the history of the Caribbean. The people of Haiti are suffering. They're unable to deal with their basic needs and are being killed indiscriminately.
Hi, this is Hold Your Fire, a podcast by the International Crisis Group. I'm Richard Atwood. Last week, gangs seized much of the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince. That was Guyana President Irfan Ali, who chairs the Caribbean regional bloc CARICOM, talking about the crisis. Since the killing of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse in July 2021, gang violence has spiraled. Already before this latest offensive, gangs controlled more than three quarters of Port-au-Prince and surrounding areas, including roads leading into the capital. Two rival gang coalitions, the G9 and the GPEP, had mostly been battling each other for turf. Now, though, in a dramatic shift of tactics, they've joined forces, attacking the airport, government buildings, police stations, and the city's jails, freeing thousands of inmates. This is gang leader Jimmy Cherizier, who's widely known as Barbecue, claiming that the gang's main aim was to overthrow Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry.
We ask the Haitian National Police and the military to take responsibility and arrest Ariel Henry. Once again, we're not against the people. The armed groups are not your enemy. These weapons that we have are not to hurt our brothers, who come from the same milieu as we do. The poor, they trust us. With these weapons, we will liberate the country.
This latest gang assault tops a long political crisis. Opposition politicians have also wanted Prime Minister Henry, who assumed power after Moise's killing, to hand over or at least share power. He'd refused and called for foreign forces to help stabilise Haiti. Last October, the UN Security Council greenlit a police mission led by Kenya. As the gangs launched their offensive, Henry was in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, trying to help finalise the mission's deployment. Unable to return to Haiti, Henry has now pledged to resign and hand over to a presidential council. So does his resignation offer any hope of turning the page? And can the Kenya-led force loosen gangs' grip on the Haitian capital? To talk about all this, I'm happy to welcome back onto the show Crisis Group's Deputy Latin America Director, Renata Segura, and our Haiti expert, Diego Darin. Renata, Diego, welcome back on.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Richard.
So if listeners want more background on the crisis, including on former President Jovenel Moïse's killing, the origins and trajectory of gangs, and the record of previous foreign military interventions, then please check out the last episode we did on Haiti, which was in late 2022. Today, we're going to focus more on what's happened over the past couple of weeks and on what's coming next. So, Diego, maybe let's start then with what's happening now in Port-au-Prince. Things have calmed down a bit over the past few days, but tell us about this latest gang offensive.
Well, what we have seen is a major turning point in the strategies of the gangs since late February. Formerly, rival coalitions have joined their forces to launch coordinated attacks against state institutions and critical infrastructure, against the main ports, against the airport, police stations, and they are trying to overrun the areas that they don't yet control in the capital.
And as you say, gangs that were previously fighting each other have basically united, something that Crisis Group, that you and Renata had warned might happen a few weeks ago. And we'll come in a moment to how durable that alliance or pact is. But Diego, what do the gangs control of the city now?
Well, before it was estimated that they already controlled 80% of the capital, mostly the part of the coast and the surroundings of the metropolitan area of Port-au-Prince. Now what they are trying to do is to go towards the center of the city and try to control all the symbolic buildings of the state. They attacked the interior ministry, the education ministry, and they have achieved to take control of several areas that they didn't control some weeks ago. And as they have been striking simultaneously on several fronts, they have splitted the Haitian security forces that have been completely overwhelmed by these large-scale attacks.
And the airport, they haven't yet managed to seize that, right?
Yes, it's unclear if they haven't managed or they don't want to do it. What they have been doing, for example, for the airport, they have been making attacks at night. They tried a weekend ago to overrun the airport, but since then they haven't really tried to seize control of the airport. What they have been doing is trying to paralyze and to prove the Haitian government that they are the ones in power, that they can destabilize the Haitian state at any given moment when they wish to do so. Maybe if they overplay their hand, they fear that there might be a tougher stance by Haiti's international partners that could, for example, decide maybe not to wait until the deployment of a multinational mission, but for example, for the US to send Marines, although the US has said that they hasn't got any appetite to send Marines.
With the airport, it is interesting that they've broken pieces of the wall. So the airport doesn't have a whole perimeter that is safe. So they haven't entered, but they can enter if they decide to do it. So there is quite a bit of calculation about what they're doing and they're not doing.
The prison breaks, I assume those have also allowed thousands more potential gang members to escape and fill up the ranks of the gangs.
Well, the gangs attacked almost simultaneously at the same night the two main prisons in the capital, well, in the metropolitan area, the National Penitentiary, which is in downtown Port-au-Prince, and the prison of Croix des Bouquets, which was in fact the two prisons where most gang members that were arrested were held. And approximately 4,700 prisoners escaped from there. That is almost half of the total prison population in Haiti. So many of them could join or rejoin the ranks of the gangs.
So tell us a bit about this pact, what it's known as the Vivre Ensemble, which in Creole is living together, basically between the two big coalitions of gangs. One is the G9, the leader of which we heard in the intro, Jimmy Chérizier, and the other, the GPEP. So until recently, they were warring for territory, but now what seemingly threatened by the potential deployment of the Kenya-led police mission that we heard about, they've joined forces.
Well, I think that it's better to define what is happening between the former rival coalitions as a non-aggression pact rather than an alliance. And this is not new. They have already presented this initiative of Vivre Ensemble in September while former Prime Minister Ariel Henry was in New York trying to press the Security Council to authorize the security mission for Haiti. So while he was in New York, Jimmy Chérizier, known as Barbecue, the leader of the G9, organized a press conference and said that gangs were going to live together, presenting this alliance Vivre Ensemble, that they were halting their attacks against civilians, that they were going to create a new environment, a new Haiti. They were trying to make Haitians that have been forced to flee the country to come back, and trying to discourage somehow the Security Council from authorizing this mission. And right now, it's a very different display in which they have presented Vivre Ensemble. They are not pledging for peace. They are making war against the state. They demanded Ariel Henry to step down. They surrounded the airport in order to prevent him from returning to the country. The question now is, how long will this non-aggression pact stand? As the last time they presented Vivre Ensemble, it only lasted a couple of days before they were clashing each other again.
Do we know, Diego, roughly how many gang members there are combined in total?
Yes, there are very different estimates. The G9 that is presented both in Haiti and abroad as the most powerful coalition has much less armed members than the GPEP. The GPEP right now, which was until a week ago, the rival coalition of the G9, has been expanding its territories in the surrounding areas of the capital, and they have been able to recruit forcibly or not many young men in the last few years. But it is estimated that all the gangs, all the powerful gangs in Port-au-Prince should have between 6,000 or 12,000 armed members in total.
That's the total of the GPEP and the G9 and all the others.
Yes. And this is without taking into account maybe the ones that joined their ranks after they escaped from prisons a week ago.
And the weapons that they're using, I know in the prison breaks they used not armed drones but surveillance drones, and they have a lot more high-caliber, powerful weapons than they did some time ago.
Well, the gangs have been using increasingly powerful weapons. Before, they were only using, some years ago, gang members only used handguns or machetes or things like that. Right now, they have been able to purchase great amounts of high caliber weapons. And the main problem for the Haitian police to fend off their attacks is that they have large amounts of ammunition. And besides that, they also have proven in their recent operations to have better equipment and logistics to conduct these operations during the attacks against both the prisons and other attacks they have been mounting in recent weeks. They have been using drones, and this has given them the upper hand against the police.
And most of these weapons they're getting from the US, right? I mean, the people are taking them through Florida, I guess.
It's difficult, obviously, to say exactly, you know, like nobody has seen exactly all the weapons, but a big amount of the weapons that have been retrieved by the Haitian police from the gangs are actually US manufactured. And we have known for quite a bit of time that a lot of them are coming from Florida. So there is quite an active commercial route between ports outside of Miami and Port-au-Prince. And hidden in the cargo, usually a lot of the weapons and the ammunition comes. There's also weapons coming from elsewhere, from Colombia, from Jamaica, from DR. Actually, when Dominican Republic closed the border, there were reports that some of the gangs had difficulties accessing ammunition, but it's certain that a big chunk of the weapons are coming from the US.
It is interesting also that the first time that Vivre Ensemble was presented in Haiti in September, it was also 2 or 3 weeks after the border with the Dominican Republic was closed. And some sources said that they were making this non-aggression pact because they didn't have enough ammunition to fight.
And I want to come and talk in a moment about Chelicie, the leader of G9. But could you just say a word or two first about living conditions in Port-au-Prince? I mean, they were very bad before, but do we know what the impact of this latest bout of fighting is?
Well, the overall situation has been really dire and is deteriorating by the day. Half of the population need humanitarian aid. Over 4 million Haitians suffer from acute levels of food insecurity. Right now, there are roughly 362,000 forcibly displaced persons across the country. Most of them had to flee the gang violence in the capital. And right now, what is really concerning is that as the gangs control all the gateways to the capital, people are trapped in Port-au-Prince and they are just trying to find refuge in makeshift camps, as schools, as public places where they live in extremely poor sanitary conditions. They have a very difficult access to food, water, medicine, health services. And the gangs have also been attacking, as they very frequently do, the oil terminal and the main container terminal. So there are many concerns about what the impact will be in the access to food and essential goods in the capital. They have overrun several hospitals in the past weeks. There is only one state hospital that is still functioning in the capital, but they're struggling to find fuel, oxygen, medical supplies, so they are not able to function properly.
And a lot, from what I understand, a lot of the Haitian economy revolves around fuel.
Yeah, I think it's really important for listeners who live in the West that take for granted electricity and potable water. And that is something that a lot of households in Haiti don't have. So people rely on electric plants that run on gasoline. So if they don't have gasoline, not only they don't have electricity, they don't have light at night, they don't have refrigeration, but they also don't have access to potable water. In a country where there is cholera active and where we've seen in the past spread of cholera really quickly, this is a concern. But in addition, the combats on the street in Port-au-Prince are so intense that people are afraid of leaving their house. So people are just consuming the food that they had at home. So people are running out of food, you know, never mind speaking about going to school or any other normal activities. Life has just been seriously upended. And Diego, who is in constant touch with people in Port-au-Prince, the clamor that is coming from Haitians for the world to help them is really desperate. The messages are just heartbreaking. The situation on the ground for everyday Haitians is just really hellish at this moment.
And last time you were both on, so just over a year ago, we talked about the relationship between gangs, especially the G9, and people in areas that they control. So gang members are often recruited locally from the areas that they're operating in, but it's mostly a kind of predatory relationship gangs are involved in, kidnapping for ransom, drug trafficking, a lot of extortion. And gang members, gangs, whether those in the G9 or the GPEP, hold sway, often with a lot of violence, including a lot of sexual violence. That's still the case. That's still the right way to understand it.
Well, even if the gangs share some common features in how they operate, it's difficult to put them in the same category. Each leader has a way to deal with things in a very different way. And, well, for example, the G9 that has been controlling roughly the same territory for several years, that hasn't been trying to expand to overall new areas. Most of the gangs of the G9 have been really trying to convince the people that they are not only the de facto authorities there, but in some way people have been forced to think that these leaders are the ones who protect them. But in the other hand, they understand that these are also warlords and they are responsible for all this increasing violence they have been suffering.
So tell us a bit about gang leader Jimmy Cherizier, or Barbecue. He's what, a former policeman, now gang leader, responsible for a lot of violence, but also increasingly articulating political goals, entertaining political aspirations.
Well, Cherizier is a very well-trained police officer. He served in the police for 14 years. He was part of a special unit of the Haitian police and also a gang leader from the gang Del Massis. So, and from the beginning, he did have strong connections with politicians that were really, really close to the late President Jovenel Moïse, who was killed in 2021. In fact, there are very documented reports about how officials from Moïse government facilitated or encouraged the creation of the G9 gang alliance. And from the beginning, Cherizier tried to give this some kind of apparent ideology. It is not only called the G9, it is called Revolutionary Forces, G9 Family and Allies. And since the creation of the G9 in 2020, he has been trying to strengthen his image as a politician. And right now he is presenting himself as not only the spokesperson, but also the president of this broader federation called Vivre Ensemble. And he claimed that the first step of their alleged battle was to topple the government, but then it was to liberate the country from the oppression of the elites. But what is not clear is to which extent other leaders that are gathered in this broader federation, Vivre Ensemble, for a couple of weeks now, really are aligned with his position. There are at least two other gang leaders that could have political ambitions, but they are smart enough to understand that in the short term, it won't be possible for them to become active politicians in the country.
But it seems equally unlikely that, I mean, Cherizier is sanctioned by the US, he's responsible for massacres, he's responsible for an enormous amount of violence in Haiti. So whatever his political aspirations, it's also going to be quite a journey for him to become part of Haitian politics.
He had in the past said at some point that he wanted to be part of Henry's cabinet. And obviously, right now, he would like to be considered to be part of this new transitional government that is being formed. However, it is highly unlikely that either Haitians that have experienced firsthand the violence that he has exerted, but also the international community, would actually be agreeable to something like that. If for any other reason, because one of the agreement that came out of Jamaica was very clear in stating that nobody that had a pending criminal case or had been convicted of criminal activity could be part of this presidential council. So that automatically leaves him out. However, the fact that he's out of government doesn't mean that he's not going to be a very important political figure. Not as somebody that really has an ideology and is really invested in the betterment of the Haitian lives, because his actions speak to the contrary, but he has real power. And in that sense, he is somebody that needs to be dealt with either through security means, or there'll have to be at some point a conversation with them.
Let's turn then to the politics and how those relate to what the gangs are doing. So Prime Minister Henri has said he'll resign as soon as the presidential council is formed. CARICOM, the Caribbean community, the regional bloc, and others who have been mediating for some time among Haitian political leaders, including those from the opposition coalition, the Montana Group, are now sort of pushing them to try and form that council.
So essentially the council is formed by seven slots for either private sector, opposition such as Montana, or political parties or political coalitions. And each of these groups have been given 48 hours to come up with a name to, you know, be the individuals that will shape that will form part of this presidential council. The presidential council then is supposed to designate a prime minister that will replace Henry. This sort of model follows the constitutional model of governance that Haiti has traditionally had, with a president, a prime minister. Obviously, in this case, there will be like multiple people in instead of one president. And constitutionally, at least, the president has more power than the prime minister. And we've seen Henry occupy such a big space in politics because there hasn't been a president since the assassination of Moïse. And then it is assumed that there will also be a cabinet. So what we're hoping for right now is a rather speedy, at least, designation of who are the people that are going to be part of the presidential council. And then it's unlikely that it's going to be incredibly speedy, but hopefully relatively soon they will be able to find a figure that everybody agrees on to be the person in charge of being the prime minister. But clearly, there's a lot of polarization. There's a lot of differences of opinion of who should be part of this government or not. And the fact that we're working really outside of any constitutional guidelines at this point, this is sort of all kind of invented on the fly, had made it very difficult for an agreement to come to fruition.
The result of this last emergency meeting in Jamaica, in which this agreement was reached, it is a huge step. This is something that we had been waiting for over 2 years and a half since the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, for the main political forces in Haiti to come together and to make an agreement on the way forward, to make a transitional government that could be seen as more legitimate both to Haitians and the international community. The problem is that this is a 7-member presidential council, and maybe it will be difficult to make decisions, although this body will make its decisions on a majority criteria. Another concern is that some of the political forces that were selected to appoint a representative have been criticizing this accord. Most notably Jean-Charles Moïse, which is a very popular left-wing politician from the north of the country, said this week that he rejected the accord. And Jean-Charles Moïse, it is also very important to note, is the closest political ally of Guy Philippe. Guy Philippe is a former police commander, a former rebel who had a very important role in the coup d'etat that forced President Jean-Bertrand Aristide into exile in 2004, 20 years ago. And he was in prison in the United States for charges of laundering money from drug trafficking. And he was repatriated to Haiti in November. Since he arrived to Haiti, he started calling for toppling the government of Ariel Henry through a peaceful revolution. And he is also known, and he doesn't hide this. He has ties with gangs. He communicates with several leaders. He was not part of the discussions of Jamaica and the previous formal discussions with international mediators. And with Jean-Charles Moïse, this popular politician of the north of the country, they made an alliance some weeks ago to form a government after Ariel Henry would resign. So it is concerning that as we are seeing that there may be a hope for a solution to move forward, there was a breakthrough in negotiations to establish a new transitional council, maybe some politicians could be tempted to ally themselves with gangs to impose themselves as the ones who will rule Haiti.
And Guy Philippe is close to Cherizier himself?
So it's hard to know at this particular point how much coordination there is between Guy Philippe and Cherizier. But what is very clear is that the links between the gangs and the politicians that have been a historical feature of Haiti have not disappeared. We're talking about something that has gone on for decades and that is obviously not going to go away. After the Canada in particular sanctioned ex-president Martelly and others, because of their links with the gangs, that did send a chilling message to many of the elites. And so a lot of the gangs stopped receiving the money that they normally would on a monthly basis from their patrons.
These were US and Canadian sanctions against politicians with ties to gangs, and they did help sever those links, or at least the more visible links.
Yeah, particularly the Canadians, because they've included, more sort of notable figures in politics. So the sanctions did have an impact quite immediate in that it sort of sent this message. You know, Cherizier is part of the sanctions. He's been sanctioned by the UN. It's also in sanctions by the US. But that's kind of a symbolic move, right? It's not that Cherizier has bank accounts in New York and apartments in Paris that he would like to be visiting. But the Haitian elites, the political and economic elites, do. They do have bank accounts abroad. They do travel. And being in the sanctions is obviously something that really concerns them. So that has quieted a little bit down the direct links. That had an unintended consequence. That was that a lot of the gangs then turned to the population to try and make up for those lost resources. And so we saw an increase in kidnapping and an increase in extortion. However, in the particular case of Guy Philippe and Jean-Charles Moïse and Cherizier, you know, they all have embraced this kind of revolutionary discourse in which they have identified the elites in a very hypocritical way, because we know that they had been feeding from the elites for a long time. But now they've sort of noted them as the enemy to be defeated. They are phrasing the agreement in Jamaica as sort of echoing that elite logic that had been existing in Haiti for so long and had left the country in the terrible place where it is. So it is of concern.
Let's move then to the Kenya-led mission. And I know you've both, with our Africa colleagues, been quite involved in talking to the officials involved. And the idea, from what I understand it, is that Kenya would send some of its paramilitary general service unit police, which is quite a well-drilled force, has quite a fearsome reputation. It's fought Al-Shabaab, so Islamist militants, and gangs in parts of Nairobi. Other countries have also offered to contribute and send police. So what was the plan before the gang's latest offensive?
So essentially, last October, the United Nations Security Council approved a resolution that endorsed this mission to come. And their mandate was to support the National Haitian Police in combating the gangs. There was a bit of back and forth. The U.S. essentially wanted them first to be a static force in which they would defend institutions and perhaps clean roads. But after the Kenyans visited Haiti, it became very clear that that would not be sufficient and that that would not respond to the needs of the Haiti people, that really needed the forces to go and try and really capture the leadership and try and regain territory. So originally the plan had been that the Kenyans were going to send a smaller mission of a couple hundred men to establish the initial footprint, to do intelligence, and then prepare for the deployment of the bigger contingent. Kenya has offered 1,500 policemen. Benin has said between 1,500 and 2,000, and then a number of Caribbean countries have also offered some troops. So the plan was to move ahead originally early this year, but then the Kenyan Supreme Court in late January said that the deployment was illegal because Kenya and Haiti did not have a reciprocal security agreement signed, which was a precondition, according to the judges, for this to be able to happen. And so very quickly, Kenyan authorities worked with their Haitian counterparts to actually establish this agreement. And that was precisely what Henry was doing in Nairobi, overseeing the signing of the agreement when the uprising of the gangs started and, you know, leaving him stranded outside of the country.
And if people want more on the debates about the mission in Kenya, you should check out last week's episode of our sister podcast, The Horn. But what, Kenyan President William Ruto was in Jamaica at this latest round of emergency talks over the past week, and what are plans now for the mission?
President Ruto was present in a part of the meetings that were held in Jamaica. And at first, what we heard is that just Kenya was putting a pause in the plans for sending to lead the multinational mission until there was a new transitional government in place. But also what it might be concerning for Kenya is that the situation on the ground has really changed. And maybe now having this united front that could be confronting their forces. But President Ruto sent a message some days ago in which he said that the plans to send the multinational force would go ahead as soon as the presidential council would be installed.
The Kenyans really had feared, understandably, to come to Haiti to be seen as an invader force, right? And so for them, it was very important that there was a political agreement in place before they landed. They wanted to know that they were going to be welcomed by the Haitians. And we know that the majority of Haitians are in support of the mission. But now with this transition, they really understandably want to have a counterpart, just purely on administrative terms, of who is going to be the person with whom they will be dealing on a daily basis, but also an understanding that this is a government that is going to have certain stability and that things are not going to change politically dramatically once they are in the ground. And so the signals that we're hearing from Nairobi is that they're worried, but that this doesn't mean that there's a scratching of the plans, that they just have questions that need answers, but that as soon as there's something more stable in place, then the mission should be able to go ahead as planned.
And part of the context for this is that foreign missions in Haiti, UN missions, US operations, they have a very checkered record in Haiti, and we talked about this last time you were on the show. But in terms of the challenge that the Kenya-led mission might face, coming in, as you say, to what is a very different security environment, particularly if the gangs stay united, if this pact holds. On the one hand, maybe you could argue that gangs haven't really been tested for a while. The Haitian police are quite weak. Maybe with a more credible force, Kenyan paramilitaries, they might prove less powerful, less potent than they currently appear. On the other hand, for a foreign force, and particularly one that doesn't speak French or Creole, that doesn't know the terrain, fighting thousands of well-armed gang members in the dense streets of Port-au-Prince, that could be quite a formidable challenge, plus, of course, a political transition that could well end up being quite rocky.
Well, if Vivre Ensemble continues to stand when the foreign security forces will deploy, it will be a huge challenge. And this is a very important question, is how sustainable is this new broader alliances between formal rival gangs? These gangs have very much to lose. And as long as they don't think they have an alternative way out through, for example, through discussions with Haitian authorities, they will do all they can to confront the foreign security forces. And before they are deployed, all they can do to discourage the foreign forces from being deployed. But obviously, if a foreign force comes with enough effective skills in urban combat, as, for example, the military police of Kenya that will be deployed in Haiti, well-trained and really well-equipped, they could, well, very likely make a difference and help the Haitian police to regain the upper hand. If the gangs fear a security force that would have equipment that they don't have, for example, helicopters, armored vehicles, combat drones, it will be very hard for gangs if they are faced to a very well-equipped and professional force.
Several of the people that know the gangs operating very well are particularly emphatic about aerial equipment, either drones or helicopters, that would be not only strategically key, but also a dissuasive force. And we have to remember that a lot of these gang members are just kids, in many cases, literally children, that have been joining the force out of lack of opportunities. So if they see that they're going to be attacked aerially, that would be something that what we're hoping is will be dissuasive enough. I think there is no doubt that there is going to have to be combat with the gangs. Unfortunately, that seems inescapable at this point. But also simultaneously, we need to leave the opportunity for those kids that are deciding that they're not going to be part of the gangs anymore, be it out of fear or a change of heart, and actually open some lines for them to start some sort of demobilization, which is something that is not on the table at the moment, but that we hope will be on the table at the moment that the Kenyans deploy.
And the multinational force, the Kenya-led force, they're talking now about what? About 5,000 police paramilitaries from the countries that you mentioned earlier, Renata. So Kenya, Benin, some Caribbean countries. Do we have a sense of sort of precisely what they're going to try and do? Is it about protecting or taking back key infrastructure or actually sort of loosening gangs' grip on the areas they control? How much are they actually going to take the fight to gangs in their strongholds?
What a foreign force could do if it is deployed on the ground, it of course will depend on how many will be deployed and how skilled they are. And if they are able to avoid any leaks of information, that is one of the main challenges in the operations, as many police officers are in some kind of collusion with gangs. But if this force is able to conduct some successful operations in very strategic areas that are in not so complicated terrain, for example, not intervening in their first operations in the strongholds of the gangs, but rather in areas where there is not so many civilians, where operations could be conducted with strong intelligence gathering, trying to reduce as much as possible the harm that could be inflicted on civilians, well, this could show the gangs that the game has changed.
I mean, I think originally we had hoped that the force would come and would be able to go into the neighborhoods and actually make life possible again. I think at this particular moment, that seems unrealistic, at least in the first stage. So I think we're talking about regaining particularly access to the oil terminals, which is essential for people's lives, roads. The hospitals, unfortunately, have been very much dismantled. Everything has been stolen, including like windows and doors. So that is going to take longer to be able to put that back. A lot of the displaced people have been living in schools. So that kind of normality is nowhere close, but at least allow people to be able to go out to shop, gain access to gasoline, and have the roads be open. That would be a significant first step.
And I mean, you mentioned this a bit earlier, but what do you make of prospects for diplomacy with gang leaders? I mean, political compromises might seem sort of hard to imagine, but maybe ways at least of persuading them to pull back from some areas. As we talked about, many politicians, some politicians do have these links to gang leaders. Perhaps there might be ways to at least reduce violence.
I think the biggest question mark for the international community, for Kenya and for the transitional government when it does get formed, is how to combine a security strategy with some sort of diplomacy and peacemaking that allows the situation to get better without it having to be just a full-on war until all of the gangs are defeated, which we don't know if that's going to happen anytime soon. So the Cherissier and other gang leaders would like to see an amnesty some of them have political ambitions, and so they would like to be seen as members of the government. That seems, the latter seems unlikely, but there are people in Haiti that have open communication channels with this gang leadership, and it is important that we continue working with them in two ways. The first one, to just reduce violence against civilians and try and negotiate some sort of violence reduction around the communities. But second, to open lines of communications to see how an eventual demobilization happens, or at least a quieting down. A key figure in this is going to be Guy Philippe. So Guy Philippe, as we talked about, has joined forces with other politicians, and they are sort of presenting themselves as an option to this transitional government. The UN and others are going to be hard forced to decide if they place sanctions on Philippe or if they actually try and keep him as a strategic person that could have access to the gangs for negotiations. I know there's very little appetite in Haiti right now to engage in negotiations with these people that have brought the country to such a terrible state. But we need to be pragmatic about what are the likelihood of the forces really militarily defeating them. And what we need is to bring some stability. And I think at some point, there's going to have to be a negotiation with the gangs. It might not be what they would like to look like, right, with full amnesty and an incorporation into the government. And it might not look what some Haitians would like, which is full justice and reparations. But it seems impossible that we're going to have a resolution of this crisis without engaging in some kind of conversations with these people.
And maybe then to end, although the violence over the last few days has abated a bit, as we talked about, gangs still control much of Port-au-Prince, much of the capital, and could easily again try to capture more. And at the same time, it's going to be weeks at the earliest before the Kenya-led mission deploys. What's going to happen in the meantime? I know at the emergency meeting in Jamaica, people talked about some form of bridging force.
Well, I think that the gangs are trying to discourage the foreign mission from materializing, the multinational security mission that was approved by the Security Council. But at the same time, they don't want to prompt a tougher response by the international community. Because during the emergency meeting in Jamaica, there was not only discussions about the way forward to create a new transitional government. There was also discussions about what kind of response could help the Haitian authorities to address the very urgent security needs of the Haitian police right now, which means they need backing. Many police officers are staying at home. They don't want to go to fight gangs that are very much better armed than them. So a kind of urgent question right now is if we are still months away from the actual deployment of the multinational force, some kind of security assistance should be planned, some kind of backing for the Haitian police in the real short term, as if the gangs really wish to do so, they could seize control of the whole capital.
And actually, if they take the airport, then very difficult to see how the multinational force deploys in any case.
Yeah, the airport seems like the key part of this. There is another airport in Haiti, in Cape Haitien, although we do know that there is quite a activity around it, but that area is much less controlled by the gangs. So, you know, in theory, you could land in Cape Haitien and then come by land to Port-au-Prince, but those roads have been closed by the gangs for a long time.
And we talked earlier that the Biden administration had ruled out deploying Marines, but the US has been quite invested in trying to resolve the crisis. Secretary of State Tony Blinken was at the meeting just now in Jamaica. The US has offered to pay $100 million, maybe now even $200 million for the Kenyan force. US obviously worried about Haiti's collapse, not only for humanitarian reasons, but also presumably due to the migration it could trigger. But you still think that the administration wouldn't deploy troops?
The American government has been saying very emphatically that they are not interested in sending Marines and that that is not in the cards. And obviously with an election coming up in November, invading Haiti seems probably not ideal for the Biden administration. I mean, that said, if we start seeing an enormous amount of migration happening, and we have already seen several boats of Haitians that have been intercepted in sea, that might change the tune of Washington. or obviously a full collapse that maybe starts, for example, going into Dominican Republic, which would be extremely complicated. I think that the possibility of contractors being deployed seems more realistic. That is an option that people in Washington have been discussing for a while.
These are U.S. military contractors, in essence.
Exactly. So U.S. military contractors. So it wouldn't be members of the U.S. military forces, but it would be contractors paid by the U.S. Obviously, there is a very checkered history of the action of these contractors in the past in other countries, and so there's quite a worry about what that would mean. But given the urgency of the situation and the difficulties on deploying the mission immediately, I think it's not out of the question.
Renata, Diego, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Richard.
Hold Your Fire is a production of the International Crisis Group. I'm Richard Atwood. You can find all of our work on Haiti and the potential deployment of the Kenya-led force on our website, crisisgroup.org. Check out last week's episode of The Horn. As I mentioned, for more on background to the Kenya-led mission to the multinational force, and if you want more of the history, the background on the gangs and on Haiti's crisis, as I mentioned up top, you can go back to our previous episode, the previous Hold Your Fire episode on Haiti. I think it was December 2022. Thanks to our producers, Kevin Murphy, Heiko Schaub, and thanks, of course, to all our listeners. Please do get in touch, podcast@crisisgroup.org, or write to me directly, outward@crisisgroup.org, if you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns. If you like the show, please do leave us a 5-star rating, tell people about us, and I very much hope that you'll join us again next time.